Hello and welcome in.
First Science.
Because he shows them the magic and mystery of science in everyday living.
On Science Mixtape on Soho Radio. Good morning. You're listening to Science Mixtape with me, Matilda Hay. And whilst Valentine's Day is shouting down at us from all around, we're unashamedly jumping on that bandwagon to bring you the science of attraction. Yes, in a world increasingly dominated by online dating, Tinder hookups, and ghosting, one lady is on a mission to bring back the romance in a scientific way. I'm talking, of course, about my guest this morning, Jen Wong, co-founder of Guerrilla Science, which is the pioneer behind a new type of speed dating, sensory speed dating, putting the lust back into love. For anyone who hasn't heard of it, Guerrilla Science is an organisation that seeks to revolutionise how people experience science by mixing it with art, music and play and taking it to places where it's unexpected. So it's my great pleasure to welcome Jen to our show this morning. Good morning, Jen.
Good morning.
Now, sensory speed dating, what exactly does that involve?
So sensory speed dating basically involves getting a bunch of strangers together in a room, usually a bar or somewhere really nice, and getting people to explore together the science of attraction through a series of interactive sensory activities.
And what I think is really interesting is that you don't limit this, you don't sort of categorise by gender, do you?
No, but just because I guess today, like, the kind of gender fluidity and transdisciplinary nature of the world in which we operate makes it kind of harder to draw those boundaries, which maybe don't exist in such a constraining way anymore.
No, absolutely fascinating. I'm so excited for this show. Coming up, we're going to be taking you on a journey through each of the five senses, discovering how they help determine who's hot and who's not for you. And for our experiment today, we'll be unpicking the secrets behind sexy voices. So all you need to take part is your ears and maybe a blindfold. But as always, we want to hear from you. So we're asking, what sense do you think is the most important for attraction? You can tweet us at Science Mixtape or at Soho Radio. And our brain teaser is, what kind of flowers should you never give on Valentine's Day? So tweet us the answer if you think you know that as well. Any ideas, Jen?
Roses.
Roses. Well, I'm not going to reveal.
Yeah. So cheesy.
People who listen to this a long time know that my riddles are often kind of bad puns. So that is my clue. Now, Jen, today is your mixtape. What song are we kicking off with and why?
So we're starting with Electric Feel by MGMT, just to get everyone in the mood. You know, we're going to be exploring attraction and love and that kind of sense of excitement. So I thought it would be a good place to start.
Vision is often the first way we assess someone's attractiveness, and whilst visual beauty standards vary across cultures and eras, signs of youth, fertility and good health are almost always seen as attractive because they're associated with reproductive fitness. This is terrible news for me. I wear glasses. This is rubbish.
But you do have beautiful, youthful skin. So,
Yeah,
I thought this was fascinating because we've always said sort of the big eyes and the kind of sort of cherubic mouth and the high forehead, those are all youthful features that babies have. And I read that one of the reasons Kate Moss is so kind of universally attractive is because she has all of these youthful features, the big eyes, the big forehead, the small mouth, but she also has high cheekbones, and high cheekbones are a sign of
sexual maturity. So not only is she youthful, but she's definitely like available and reproductively fit. And that is why she's so beautiful. It's true, isn't it, Jen, that vision is probably our most dominant sense when it comes to attraction?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know what they say about eyes being the window into the mind?
Like, yeah, love at first sight.
Yeah,
all that stuff.
Totally. And so I guess when we were thinking about sensory speed dating and how we wanted the audience to go through the experience, we wanted to kind of level the playing field, if you like, and we did that by asking everyone to wear blindfolds.
So you actually removed vision to start with?
Yeah, just because it's so dominant and, you know, as humans, well, the majority of humans are very visual people and we're influenced by the way somebody looks from even before you hear them speak, for example. And I think in especially 21st century dating life, with all of the apps and kind of like Tinder is a great example of how people are written off.
It's all about looks, yeah. Isn't it? It's yeah, all yeah. about the yeah. photos. Are the photos attractive? Then you talk.
Yeah.
But even
no
then,
no point of having a bio. No one survives long enough to look at the bio. You just swipe left or right depending on what you feel.
I don't know. A good bio can, I think, make the difference between someone who's on the borderline. But I definitely, as someone who has tried online dating or app dating, you can find someone's photo attractive and then literally within about 2 seconds of meeting them in real life,
yeah.
you'll realise you don't fancy them. And mm-hmm. I could never say exactly why, but there's some sort of other vibe that is not captured in a picture. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's still visual, maybe it's how they move or the kind of confidence they exude, but or maybe it's some of my other senses kicking in once I actually see them in real life. But yeah, I definitely think as dominant as it is, vision isn't everything.
For sure. I think when we started with sensory speed dating, by taking out vision and getting people to physically put on blindfolds, there's something else in the kind of the symbolism and meaningfulness of something like a blindfold in a kind of attraction situation. But also you kind of, when you're blindfolded, you're less in control. And what we really wanted was to for people to be guided by senses other than vision for the bulk of the mm-hmm. event, which is when you have your eyes closed or your sense of vision temporarily obscured, then yeah, your mind opens up in different ways. Mm. That was what we were trying to do.
Sort of more kind of primal, it's about instinct and attractions other than sight. It kind of takes it back to something quite raw, I think.
But there have been quite a lot of studies that do look at what we are visually attracted to. I know you were telling me before that there's studies showing that they tend to be attracted to more symmetrical faces, and definitely with babies, we see babies prefer to look at symmetrical faces.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's quite a number of facial attractiveness studies which show, say, for example, if the subjects are men looking at images of female faces, the faces men tend to rate as more attractive are more symmetrical, and the thinking behind that is that more symmetrical people, both in terms of face shape and body shape, are correlated with their level of fertility.
So it's that good old reproductive fitness coming back.
Yeah, slightly problematic, I suppose, in the way in which I think science can sometimes be quite binary.
Mm.
And actually we all know that real life isn't black and white, shades of grey. And so it would be really interesting for the same kinds of studies to be done, not just in heterosexual populations, but in queer populations as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is a really good point to make, that a lot of the research we will be talking about today has been done only in heterosexual groups. But that doesn't mean that it's not applicable to other people. We just haven't got the science to kind of back that up yet. One of my favourite things was that you said the chin can be the most informative area when looking at a face. And I never think of chins as sexy. So I'm so confused by this. What am I learning by looking at someone's chin?
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it? Chins, who would have thought? But in the studies of facial attractiveness, when women are looking at male faces, faces that are considered more masculine are considered more attractive. And things like a beard or stubble help define the jawline because they do. and so more masculine features are correlated with higher testosterone levels, and women tend to find those types of male faces more attractive.
Uh-huh.
And conversely, we mentioned the kind of neoteny thing
That's the youthful look.
The youthful look.
Yeah.
For female faces being more attractive to men. And we mentioned symmetry, but also studies have found that a more tapered chin shape is considered more attractive.
Ah, there we go. So if you've got that pointy pixie chin, you're going to be winning them over. People do get chin surgery, chin plastic surgery. I think it's particularly popular in South Korea. My other absolute favourite study that I saw, just because it's quite interesting that someone thought to do this, researchers asked heterosexual men and women to rate the attractiveness of several faces of the opposite sex. But among the pictures was one of their own, which had been digitally morphed into the other sex. And almost all of them found their own morphed face to be the most attractive. So apparently you're attracted to people that look like you. Although I think this can also be explained by something called the mirror exposure effect, which is that the more you see something, the more familiar you and the more you like it. And we see our own faces every day in the mirror. So maybe that's why. Yeah. But so just going back to the sensory speed dating, what was it that inspired you to do this in the first place?
I guess at Guerrilla Science, we were always looking for ways to get people to think about science in a different way. And what we really want to do is engage people's emotions and feelings in our explorations of various topics. And so, you know, dating is one of the most exciting things that people can do in their spare time, I guess. And it was a way to get people to, I guess, overcome the kind of visual dominated culture that we currently exist in terms of the dating apps and the multiplicity of online kind of scenarios. And we wanted to bring people together again in real life and give them the possibility to explore attraction on a more physical basis without the technology getting in the way.
And what have you found from running these events? Has there been anything that surprised you about it that you weren't expecting?
I think it's really rewarding kind of seeing people having fun and getting to know each other in ways that are slightly unexpected. So if you went to a bar, you might not think that in 20 minutes you would be sniffing somebody you've never met before in various places. Usually we go for necks, or sometimes if they're feeling brave, armpits, hands as well. and I think by facilitating those kind of new connections, I guess when you meet somebody for the first time, rather than hearing about what they do or looking at them and kind of seeing how they fit into your judgment of what's attractive or not, by turning it upside down and getting people to engage in this kind of sensory way, it definitely opens the door to, I guess, slightly different conversations and kind of different types of interaction as well.
Do you know how successful these have been?
Well, in terms of people getting together.
Yeah. Guerrilla Science weddings.
Don't know. We haven't been invited to any weddings, okay. But who knows what might have happened. Mm-hmm. In terms of the festivals that we've been to where we've run this event, there have always been people kind of pairing off at the end, but, you know, we don't know whether that's been because of the sensory speed dating that they've just experienced or whether it's...
They were just attracted to each other. Anyway. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, perfect time to move on to your second song. What is it and why?
So the second song is called Open Eye Signal by John Hopkins. And I guess when we were thinking about the eyes being the window into the mind, this is kind of, I guess, a bit of a more subtle take on that.
Studies have shown that men prefer females with high-pitched, breathy voices, whilst women prefer low-pitched voices with a resonance that suggests a larger body size.
And again, of course, that's heterosexually inclined. So we are on to sense number two. This is sound and hearing, but specifically you looked at it in relation to listening to people's voices, didn't you? And what people found sexy in voices. So tell me about this round.
So this round of sensory speed dating involved people still wearing their blindfolds and pairing up with a different partner. But what happened was they were asked to share an embarrassing moment in their lives with each other. And then we then timed them for 60 seconds talking using their most sexy voice.
And why an embarrassing story?
Oh, yeah, quite a strange decision. So research, there's a few research studies which have looked at how, like what situations enable people to form stronger bonds. And the research study was looking at people sharing kind of intense feelings with people that they were not familiar with, help them to develop a more intimate relationship more quickly.
Yeah, I think that makes sense, definitely. Yeah. Like when you open up to someone and they open back to you, you instantly feel closer, don't you? Okay, so we have recreated this science mixtape style. We've got three quite random voices and I'm going to be playing them out. So listeners at home, as you're hearing these voices, I want you to think overall, which one would you be most attracted to? But also think about why. What is it that you find attractive? And is there anything you don't find attractive? And we'll be discussing in the studio our reactions to the voices. And also, I played them to a small focus group. So I'll share what the focus group thought. And interestingly, there was quite a lot of variation. It wasn't like they all found the same voice attractive. Okay, so here we go with voice number one.
So I was at a conference with several hundred people and I had lost my iPhone. I decided to find my iPhone and a very helpful person lifted up a black bag and was like, I think this is where the phone is. I looked at the black bag and realised that it was my bag, so I hadn't lost it after all, and 100 plus people helped me to find my iPhone.
Immediate reactions? So I know that in the round, you said that you then asked people to hold up a card of turned on or turned off. I mean, what cards would you two be holding up right now?
Probably turned off.
Turned off.
Interesting. Yeah. Why?
I think maybe, just something to do with I don't find iPhones very sexy.
True.
Talking about iPhones and black bags, not very sexy. Yeah.
Interesting. So it's quite... and this is what I found from the focus group. Actually, the content of the story really impacted on how you responded to the voice. I'll play the other two and then we can talk more. So here's story number two.
So at the age of about 12, I went to our local park with my little sister and decided it would be a good idea to get into the kiddie swings. Unfortunately, I didn't realise how much bigger I'd got and got stuck in the in the swings and had to call the fire service to cut me out. Obviously, I got ridiculed for, well, still to this day, so very embarrassing.
Turned on or turned off?
I think turned on a bit.
Probably neither, actually.
Neither, so you're quite ambivalent about that one. Okay, and song voice number three.
I was in a park with some friends relaxing and decided it was time to head home. I stood up and casually asked the group, anyone want to come with me and Netflix and chill? Little did I know, in my innocence, that Netflix and chill is quite a strong euphemism. And I was roundly mocked and ridiculed.
And thoughts on that one, turned off or turned on?
Turned off, I'm afraid.
Yeah, turned off.
Oh, so we didn't get you at all, Jen. but as I said to you on the phone, I think that might be because you have a particularly sexy voice yourself. So maybe just none of them match up. Iman, why turned off on that one?
Oh, I'm not sure. I think I found the story a bit too embarrassing for me being... I don't want to say too acquainted with Netflix and chill, but that I know what it means.
You know the euphemism.
So I found that... It's too embarrassing that it kind of turned me off.
Rather than building intimacy.
Yeah.
Right, so generally from this focus group that I played these two, the second voice with the story about being in a swing got quite a lot of boys saying that they found this one the most attractive for the huskiness. I mean, some of them said, oh, I don't find any of them attractive like you did, Jen, but if I had to pick one, I'd pick this one for the huskiness. One girl said, yeah, that person's using a lot of vocal fry, which is my new favourite phrase. And it means the lowest vocal register produced through a loose glottal closure, which will permit air to bubble through slowly with a popping or rattling sound of very low frequency. Yeah. One person also said that that voice sounded more promiscuous. So up to you if that turns you on or turns you off. But then there were a few people who said it sounded kind of too brash, too raspy, and too posh. Poshness was a turn-off for quite a lot of people, and also with the girl telling the bag story, some people found her too posh. Other people liked that she told quite a positive story because she found the phone in the end. Mm-hmm. And voice two was the one where the story did really make a difference. So some said he didn't sound that confident, and that the way he went up at the end of his sentences was suggested he wasn't interested or, again, not confident. But then other people were saying his voice sounded gentle and trustworthy and friendly. Mm-hmm. And so for those, he was their favourite. And then, yeah, I mean, there were people who liked each of those voices the most. And gender as well played a difference. So one person was like, well, I'm a girl and I fancy boys. So, I mean, I am most attracted to the boy's voice because he's a boy. And then she kind of went into it more, though, and then started getting over the gender thing and looking at all of them as how attractive they were. And then when I asked people, well, what would be the most attractive voice? One voice said Scarlett Johansson was the most attractive voice. And there was some boys saying they liked lower voices in women and some saying actually higher voices were cute, but maybe less sexy. So it depends if you find sexy attractive or cute attractive. And a girl saying confidence was my biggest factor. So I'm really biased by the story matter. And then as a joke, we had one member saying, well, I've stopped talking altogether and it's increased my sex appeal tenfold. I also think it must have been quite interesting doing the round that you said where you're listening blindfolded and then you get to look at the person at the end. Yeah. Because when I've heard people on the radio and then managed to see a picture of them or see them in real life, mm-hmm. I've often got a really different image mm-hmm. of them in my head mm-hmm. and it's quite weird when they mm-hmm. don't match up to your image.
It's also quite weird if you see like foreign films or films that have been dubbed and then you listen to the original actor's voice. I always find that really strange. It's just so weird how different I imagine that they sound.
So, Jen, you weren't turned on by any of those voices. What would be your ideal voice?
Ooh, good question. I don't know. I mean, I think, you know how some people have like radio voices. Like I listen to a lot of podcasts, I listen to a lot of radio. And I think people who have kind of like, I guess, mid-range voices, so not too deep, not too high-pitched, quite smooth, I suppose. Mm. That's kind of like easy on the ear, if you like. Sometimes I struggle with accents, so like I don't know, Glasgow, I never know, like,
I guess you want to be able to understand them. I quite like some accents. You said that there was a study where the study showed that people found their own accent more attractive, but then I swear loads of people are like, oh, I love Irish accents. Or
yeah, I have a fondness for Irish accents.
Well, they have those studies that show Scottish accents are supposed to be the most trustworthy.
Oh, really?
So, for example, like when people are employing people to work in call centres, often the people with Scottish accents are more favoured.
That is interesting. Yeah. So maybe it's what you're attracted to in terms of what that voice represents to you, whether it represents kind of fun or trustworthy or naughty or like exotic, you know, the French accent. Mm. And what else were you kind of sharing with the participants?
So apparently men prefer women with higher pitched voices. And that was quite an old study. And then a more recent report suggested that men perceive a raised pitch to be more attractive only if the women are demonstrating an interest in them.
Ah.
So that's kind of interesting when you go back to your focus group. I guess it shows how the research is moving on and it's, again, shades of grey rather than black and white. But it is kind of interesting to think about. So if you think about Marilyn Monroe in the 1950s, she was like the ultimate sex symbol, and the way that she spoke was very different to how women speak today. So it's quite breathy, very high pitched, and supposed to be like ultra feminine. And now, I guess,
kind of the damsel in distress, right?
Yeah.
Breathy and like,
and to some extent that those tastes are changing, but I suppose what's hard to tell with kind of psychological studies is, you know, what's the bedrock and what's kind of cultural in a way. If you look at the history of research into attraction, it's massively, you know, the historical context is really important. So the situation of women in relation to men and in terms of power and stuff, those are all factors that are kind of, I guess, things to bear in mind when you're looking at the history of psychological
research. Yeah, absolutely. No, that is really interesting. And I guess it's hard to isolate one aspect. Like you said, I think the fact that someone's showing intent in you and that changes what you like and don't like, that's really cool. On to song three.
So song three is by Jamie XX featuring Romy, and it's called Loud Places. And I guess the reason why I chose it is because I would like people to like listen to the voices that are at play in this particular song.
I built in loud places to search for someone to be quiet with, who will take me home. You go to loud places to find someone who will take you higher. Take you to higher places you can't reach without.
Our nose is able to pick up on natural chemical signals known as pheromones. These convey important physical information and genetic information. These can also activate a physiological or behavioural response in the recipient.
Yeah, so from what you said, it sounds a bit like smell is almost the thing. Maybe it's not love at first sight, it's love at first smell. Like, it sounds like it's really important. And it's more than just the perfume that you're wearing. It's kind of something that you wouldn't normally be able to describe. Can you tell me a bit more about what we know about pheromones and why we think they make such a difference?
So I guess, you know, we smell a lot of different things, and often it's kind of subconscious. So when you're smelling somebody, you take in a lot of information about who that person is, and we don't even realise it. So it's so bedded into how our brains are wired and how our bodies are wired that it's just another tool in how we understand the world and the people around us. So there's a thing called MHC complex. Do you guys know?
Yes, the major histocompatibility complex. Yeah. I had to work really hard to learn how to pronounce that.
It's pretty tricky. Can I just call it an MHC?
Yeah.
So the MHC is kind of involved in our immune system and how our immune system functions. And basically when...
It's determined by your genes, isn't it? Like different genes will give you different MHC complexes.
Yeah, absolutely. And you want to avoid mating with somebody who has a similar MHC to you, because it will mean that your offspring, if you do that, then go on to produce any offspring, are less able to cope with a wider range of all the things that are coming out your immune system.
I guess that kind of makes sense. If you mate with someone that has a different MHC to you, you have a wider spread of these MHC genes.
Absolutely. And so the studies have shown that women prefer men's body odour who have more dissimilar MHC.
So we can actually smell someone's MHC.
Yeah. And actually the point at which these women were in their menstrual cycle was the most fertile part. So, I don't know, something in how you work helps you sniff out who the best mate is, if you're thinking about mates.
And it's all kind of subconscious, because I wouldn't be able to smell you guys and be like, you have genetically different DNA to me. But maybe actually, if I prefer one of you, maybe that is what I'm doing.
Yeah, interestingly, studies in women who are on the oral contraceptive, so the pill, the effect changes. So then you start preferring people who smell close, who are more similar to you in terms of MHC than different.
Oh, that's really interesting.
That's really weird.
Yeah. Wow, so actually the pill could be determining who you find attractive.
Potentially.
Yeah. Selecting, I mean, I'm not going to make that as a bold claim. This is just, you know, studies are studies and you can't. So what did you do for the smell of attraction round? Like, I know you were saying right at the beginning that it was funny watching people sniff each other in unusual places. But yeah. Tell me more about that.
So with this round, people again found a different partner. They are still blindfolded. And at first we asked them to smell each other's hands as a kind of... friendly entry point to where you're putting your nose, and if they then and this is all up to the people actually doing the activity, but if they felt comfortable, we asked them to move from sniffing the other person's hand to move on to their kind of neck region, and in some cases armpits as well. And obviously we left it up to the actual people as to whether they were going to go that far
and sniff the armpit.
Quite a lot of people did. There's something about having a blindfold on, which I suppose empowers you to act in ways you wouldn't necessarily normally do.
And I guess if you've already like sort of jumped on board and like, I'm doing this thing, you're probably more open to going the whole way with it.
And maybe it's having sort of vision removed for you that you need to explore, you need to find other ways to get information from your environment. So turn to your other senses.
Absolutely. And then after that, we asked them to take their blindfolds off. And we had these samples of pheromone on slips of paper that people then smelt. And to some people, it smells really attractive and kind of sweet. And to others, it really stinks. And so again, like watching from how people interacted with it is kind of interesting.
And it's the same pheromone that everyone smelt.
Yeah.
Gosh, that's fascinating. And is that like chemically produced, or is that you've literally just got someone to sweat and you've wiped it on a potato?
It's a chemical. Yeah, but... yeah, people respond to it very differently, and it's because people are all different.
I think the most famous study around smell that I've heard of is the T-shirt study.
Mm-hmm.
Did you...
Yeah, I've seen this.
Would you mind telling our listeners about that? Did you base any of it on this study?
So we did a smelly T-shirt test, not as part of sensory speed dating, but as part of a project we were looking at.
Oh, cool, so you've done it yourself.
And that was... really interesting because we got people to wear the same t-shirt over a number of days. I think it was about 10. And yeah, like when they went to bed every night, they wore the same t-shirt. And then they then passed the t-shirts on to the researchers who made up these kind of smell kits that we then took to a music festival. And then we got people to rate how attractive the armpit regions of each t-shirt were, including one t-shirt that was worn by an orangutan. And actually people found the orangutan to be more attractive than, I think there were 4 volunteers, 5 if you included the orangutan. And yeah, in terms of where the orangutan sat in the spectrum, it was kind of towards the top end of attractiveness, which is kind of interesting.
Really interesting. I don't know what to take from that. What does that mean?
Yeah, we don't know. It's either
like, maybe it's like people liking the kind of earthy outdoor, or there's a particular
maybe it's
strong
that kind of smell that's not the same as you, and this is so unfamiliar.
That's true. It's so
attractive.
Genetically different.
Maybe.
Wow. But then the other senses would kick in and say, hey, he doesn't look like me.
That's a bit wrong.
I don't understand him. I don't find those hoots particularly attractive. So at this stage, smell, you have been vetoed. I remember someone just seeing it described like that all the senses have a part to play, but they all have a veto as well. And taste is another one. So when you kiss someone, this is, you know, it's the first time you really taste them. We don't go around licking each other. And obviously there's more than just the taste when you do kiss someone. There's kind of the style of the kiss and things like that. But lots of people will say that, you know, a kiss turns them off. And taste is 90% smell. So is it the same sort of thing? Is it a kind of pheromone, like genetic testing thing going on when you taste someone?
I guess it's linked. But with sensory speed dating, what we did was... there's also something to do with the behaviours that we do around food, like sharing, as well as what's actually in the food and what you actually end up tasting. So with the taste round of sensory speed dating, we gave each pair.
Yeah, because obviously you can't get people to kiss each other, can you?
So. Yeah, it was kind of like, oh, different kinds of risks going on. But to explore the sense of taste. We gave each pair a little plate of food on which there was something like cherry tomatoes, raw kale, chocolate, and nutmeg. And we got people to feed each other. And again, they were blindfolded, which made it kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Like, how do you aim for somebody's mouth when you can't see them? But yeah, there was a study done which looked at sharing behaviour and food in chimpanzees and how they then tested the chimpanzee's urine to measure the levels of oxytocin, which is a hormone that's involved in bonding. And yeah, they found that sharing food led to a high release of oxytocin. And it's the same hormone that is involved in like the bond between the mother and child as well. So it's really, really powerful.
Yeah. Thing. And it's released by laser. It's like released by just cuddling or touching the skin,
yeah.
Which we're going to come on to later.
But. Absolutely.
No, I think if someone fed me kale, that'd be thoroughly turned off.
And was there a reason that you chose these particular foods? Because I would have thought, you know, everyone says chocolate's the equivalent to sex, or, you know, sugar is so rewarding. And why did you pick cherry tomatoes and carrots?
Because they contain carotenoids, which are compounds that are also in chocolate. So if you eat too many carrots, you end up looking yellow because of the amount of carotenoids you're eating. But
so wait, these chemicals in the food can then affect the colour of your skin?
Yes, and the kind of colour of your skin, basically it gives you like a healthy glow, and a healthy glow is considered to be more attractive.
Yeah, of course.
So what you eat definitely does impact on...
on how you look.
Mm. Exactly.
And then of course there's... was nutmeg in there as an aphrodisiac?
Yes. Yeah, so I think studies have been done on rats, and nutmeg apparently increases libido in rats. So we were kind of looking at that, but just on a human level.
Mm. I don't think I've ever eaten pure nutmeg, but there seems to be quite a lot of debate, because I did a little bit of looking into aphrodisiacs, as to whether aphrodisiacs actually are doing something chemical,
yeah,
or whether they are, for us anyway, more placebo, or whether, again, in rats or something, it's actually giving them an energy boost. But I don't think nutmeg's very and gives you loads of energy, so that one could be legit.
Could be.
Brilliant. On to song four.
So song four is So Real by Jeff Buckley. And I love Jeff Buckley generally, so, but he does mention a bit about smell in the song. So see if you can hear it.
The infamous kiss is a rich and complex exchange of tactile and chemical cues, such as the smell of one's breath and the taste of their mouth, and many people have reported being turned off by a bad kiss. Humans aren't alone in this ritual. Chimpanzees kiss, foxes and dogs lick each other's faces, some birds tap their bills together, and elephants put their trunks into each other's mouths, which is very sweet.
News just in. Milking chocolate for its health benefits. Scientists find a way to make milk chocolate as healthy as dark chocolate.
Menopause mystery. Why do female killer whales experience the change of their life?
Scientists use light to trigger killer instincts in mice.
New insight into why mothers tend to cradle their babies on the left.
Miniature brain and skull found inside 16-year-old girl's ovary.
The Knotty Professors, chemists break the world record to create the tightest knot ever made.
Great. Tell me about this whales and menopause. This sounds fascinating.
Yeah, so apparently humans, killer whales and pilot whales are the only species to actually go through the menopause.
Is that because we're the only ones that kind of live long enough to get to menopause stage?
Don't know. I don't think elephants go through menopause.
Oh, that's true, and they do live a very long time.
Yeah. So for evolutionary biologists, menopause is a bit weird, right? So why would you stop reproducing when you could go on and when you're still alive? So a long-term study of killer whales has kind of found that they start having calves around age 15, but stop in their 30s or 40s, even though they can live for somewhere near 100 years.
Whoa, I had no idea they lived that long.
I know, crazy, right?
That's quite a similar, like, starting at 15, but mainly in your 30s, 40s. I don't know, it's quite similar to almost the human lifespan, isn't it?
Yeah, but they found that when killer whale females become older, they stop reproducing at the same time as their daughters start calving. So there's a bit of a grandmother thing going on.
So it's kind of to help and support in a family unit.
Yeah, it's like they don't want to compete with their daughters who are having calves at a younger age, and maybe there's something about having calves when you're younger is
like you're more
better.
Reproductively fit. Yeah,
yeah. And then so they stop, and I guess that means that there's more resource for the whole family unit, if you like, than if all the killer whales kept on having babies.
That makes a lot of sense. And I guess definitely the way that humans used to live would have been in just kind of family units where you would have, like, grandma on hand to help you with
your
baby.
Definitely.
Wow. The story I picked was just shameful, trying to get in some Valentine's Day.
Excuse for more chocolate.
Yeah, chocolate. Basically, if you've ever heard that dark chocolate's good for you, it's apparently because it contains antioxidants, because the cocoa bean has antioxidants in it and dark chocolate has more of the cocoa bean powder in it than milk chocolate, which is extra milk. Now, Ben Goldacre would tell you that antioxidants are rubbish and it's all a big fad and they don't do anything. But a lot of other people do say that they have real health benefits. And so some scientists in North Carolina State University found that you could boost the antioxidants level of milk chocolate by adding peanut skin extract to it. And normally, if you add antioxidants, you make it taste more bitter, but the peanut skin extract is only such a small amount needed that you don't change the taste at all. So this is great news. But my favourite part about this story was that they weren't at all trying to find a way to make milk chocolate healthier. They were just trying to find a way to use peanut skins, because most peanuts are skinned and put into peanut butter and then the skins end up in landfill and it's food waste that they were trying to reduce.
Wow.
Yeah. So the bright side of peanut skins. Iman, tell me about your favourite story.
So yeah, this one's really good, mate. It's on the pursuit of killer mice. So what some scientists have done is that they're trying to look into predator-prey behaviour, and they're specifically trying to look at how prey evolve over time to kind of evade
the predator?
Yeah, the predator, or the methods that the predator uses. So what they've done is identified two separate clusters in the amygdala that are normally linked to emotion and motivation, and another is will prompt the animal to kind of clench their jaws and neck and bite to kill. So using a method called optogenetics, which is using light, they were able to artificially kind of manipulate the neurons in the mice so that they are triggered by light and to bypass the normal kind of sensory requirements to trigger that behaviour and action. And what they found is that the mice would then kind of go on a bit of a rampage and just try and target anything in sight. But more specifically, they went for objects that were smaller than them usually, and ones that looked like food. So scientists are now thinking that this behaviour, no matter kind of how erratic and violent, is in the interest of generating food, and that's why they'd use that behaviour in the environment. The mice also didn't display any kind of emotion or aggression to their fellow mice. They were very nice to them.
Yeah.
Which I think is a bit psychopathic, that they were kind of on this killing rampage but just didn't show anything. So these mice were all genetically engineered, and we're using it to study predator-prey relationships and to look at that.
Wow. The hunt.
Yeah.
Gone zombified.
The hunt. Zombie mice.
Jen, I'm also really intrigued how brain and skull tissue got inside a girl's ovary.
Yeah, this is a really weird story. So a 16-year-old girl was having surgery to remove her appendix, and they, during the operation, they found a 10-centimetre wide tumour in her ovary, and when they removed it, they found that it was actually a teratoma, and inside there were like, there was hair, there was a 3-centimetre wide brain-like structure covered by a thin section of skull bone even. So when they examined this brain-like structure, they found it was a smaller version of a cerebellum, which usually sits underneath the main part of your brain. So it's kind of one of the oldest parts of the brain, and it's involved in like balance and stuff. But yeah, in addition to that kind of smaller version of the cerebellum, they also found something that looked like a brainstem, this kind of mini brain inside this teratoma. Teratomas are really interesting. So the word stems from the Greek word teres, which means monster, apparently.
Oh, wow. And
they don't quite know how they arise or why. But one theory is that when an immature egg cell within your ovary is developing, it might go a bit weird and then develop into other body parts rather than becoming a mature egg cell and then coming out of your ovary. But yeah, they're not like, they're not that rare, apparently.
But they're kind of harmless.
Yeah, so this girl was fine, thankfully.
I guess just we are, like, our bodies are so complicated. It's not surprising that things end up in the wrong place at sometimes. Wow. And on that note, let's go on to song 5.
So song 5 is Bjork, and it's called A History of Touches, and it's from her album Vulnicura, which is perhaps one of the most intense breakup albums ever.
Moments we have been together, being there at the same time, every single touch we ever touched each other. Every single breath we ever had together is in a wondrous time lapse, with us here at this moment, the history of touches, every single
hand-holding, hugging, or having someone stroke your skin reduces levels of cortisol, your stress hormone, and causes a release of oxytocin, a hormone which promotes the feelings of trust and love.
Yeah, so we were talking about this earlier. Oxytocin is, it's known as slang as the cuddle hormone or the love hormone, and yeah, one of the best ways to release it is, well, sex and orgasm, but also just something much more gentle like stroking and cuddling and having skin-to-skin contact. So touch has been shown in lots of ways to influence subconsciously, I suppose, how people see other people. I mean, studies have shown that if a teacher touches a student on their back or their arm, that student is more likely to participate in class. The more athletes high-five or hug their teammates, the better their game is. And if a waitress touches the arm or shoulder of a customer, she will often get a larger tip. So, yeah, I guess being tactile, I suppose, might suggest you're approachable or you're being friendly, and it's caring to touch someone, isn't it?
Yeah.
The only other time that you'd touch someone, I suppose, is if in a physical, violent way. But yeah, if it's not violent, then it's caring. But I suppose you didn't really have a round on touch, did you?
No. So we use touch in most of the rounds anyway, partly because when you have a bunch of blindfolded strangers, they will need to, I guess, communicate interpersonally through touching.
And I guess if they're feeding each other or smelling each other, absolutely, that all involves bodily contact, doesn't
absolutely
it?
Absolutely, or dancing with each other with blindfolds on.
That would be interesting.
Yeah.
and fun for you to watch.
Absolutely. I guess, you know, even beyond the kind of dating scenario, touch is very integral to how we communicate as humans. So like we shake hands, we do cheek kisses. I guess touch is one of the earlier senses to develop as well. So we're exploring the world through our sense of touch from
really young.
Really young.
I think it's actually the first one, because you grow your skin really early on in the womb. And there was something that hit the news last year, which was all about how temperature could influence your opinion of someone as well. So they did an experiment where people didn't realise the experiment had begun, and they were just asked to hold the experimenter's coffee, and either the coffee was hot or it was iced. Mm-hmm. And then they had to read about a story of a hypothetical person, and they were asked to rate that person's personality. And apparently if they'd held the hot coffee, they perceived the person as happier, more social, more generous and better natured. But if they'd held the iced coffee, they often rated them as cold, stoic and unaffectionate. So even just like the temperature of your environment, I suppose, it's more like your environment impacting on someone else. And also, if you do something that raises your adrenaline, you're more likely to find someone attractive because your heart is already beating, and so your body interprets it the wrong way. I think in a way it's probably the most wide-ranging of our senses. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely, because if you think about your skin, it's, you know, the largest organ in your body, and it's got touch receptors all over it. So, you know, this is our, as sensory beings, like the sense of touch is probably one of the senses that we're most receptive to in a way.
Now, we are running out of time. We've gone through our five senses, but I want to ask you a little bit more about how you started Guerrilla Science in the first place, because you are one of the co-founders and it's been going since 2008. So tell me about that journey, how you started it and how it's grown.
Sure. So Guerrilla Science was born out of the Secret Garden Party Music Festival,
which is
a great festival, really very artsy, very visual and very playful. And I think myself and the other co-founders felt that we wanted to celebrate science as a way of knowing about the world, but we wanted to approach science from, I guess, external perspectives to science, to just make it a bit more accessible to people who perhaps weren't as interested in science as we were, or had bad experiences learning science at school. We've all had those. It was very much, it grew quite organically out of the celebratory nature of the music festival, where people are open-minded, curious and willing to try new things. And I guess from there,
because you're not just at festivals anymore, are you? Like, I've seen you at Glastonbury lots of other music festivals, but you've moved to other spaces.
Yeah, so this idea of taking science to unexpected places is very much at the core of what we're trying to do. So we've done events and activities from places like disused World War II bunkers in London to Victorian sewage pumping stations just outside of London. We're also operating in New York at the moment as well. And yeah, that kind of demand for people wanting to experience more and more kind of, I guess it's in a way, it's kind of like edutainment. People are increasingly looking for ways to engage in culture that perhaps has a more meaningful streak to it. And I think, you know, when you turn to science, you're never going to run out of inspiration. And so it's kind of like the perfect thing to experiment with when you're looking at different ways of engagement. And also this kind of transdisciplinary trend that the world seems to be moving towards, where information is so accessible, you know, you could become an expert in everything in a way. And so science is becoming, you know, ever more accessible to people, but the way in which you engage with it makes a big difference.
Yeah, and actually it's not about the information, it's about the experience and about being immersed in another world, I suppose. Amazing. And your events sound so cool. That you told me before about one all about the brain, where you sort of created a space to be like the brain, and then there were brain scientists there and people had a banquet and ate brains.
That was, you know, tasty.
I would love to have been able to go to that, but they're only ever on for a short period of time. Is that something that you like, or something that you're hoping to change? Is it kind of sad almost when you put a lot of work into an event?
I think when you work in events, like, there's always this really kind of, there's a bit of a rush, isn't there? And then when it's done and you've pulled it off successfully, that's really amazing. I think now we're looking to make guerrilla science more sustainable. And so we will be doing more events both in London and New York. And we'll be doing events that span both cities. So
awesome.
We'll keep you posted.
Yeah.
But it's a really exciting time for us. And we're, you know, going to continue to experiment doing stuff in different ways. And yeah, push the boundaries even further.
Yeah, I'm such a huge fan of guerrilla science. Because the idea of looking at science in a kind of creative way and communicating it meaningfully and changing people's opinions, I think it's just so important, because I meet loads of people who hate science, or tell me that they hate science, or tell me that they hate maths. They were never good at it. They're never going to be good at it. They're never going to understand it. And I think it's really important to challenge that and kind of, I'm not going to say trick people into learning science, but kind of get them to experience it in a more positive way. I'm a huge fan.
Thank you.
And if anyone does want to take part in your sensory speed dating, are there any more events coming up?
There will be. We'll be providing details on our website of events happening in London and also New York.
Great. And finally, we've got to go through the brain teaser. So,
yes.
Jen, you thought roses. Iman, what do you think?
I thought plain flour.
Like baking flour?
Baking flour. Because I know you, and I know you like to put twists and things.
That's not a bad idea. Yeah. Have we had any guesses from the Twitter?
We've had lots of people complaining that they are allergic to flour. So any kind of flowers, natural or otherwise, are bad ideas for Valentine's Day.
Okay. Well, I can reveal to you all, you were very close. But the answer is, you should not give cauliflower. There you go. Jen, thank you so much for coming today. It's been a fascinating journey through the senses. I really enjoyed it. And thank you, Iman, for all your wonderful insights. And to all our listeners, if you've enjoyed the show, you can find the rest of Science Mixtape on iTunes or any other podcast provider. And all that's left now is to play out with your final song. Jen, what is it and why?
So this is by Caribou and it's called Can't Do Without, and I've been listening to it on repeat for a long time now.
For more Science Mixtape, you can find our shows on Audioboom, iTunes, or any other podcast provider. Or join us live every Saturday at 10 a.m. on Soho Radio, recently voted the best online radio station in the world.